The Tom Woods Show, episode 495.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. If you're thinking about starting that blog, remember you can get the best price Bluehost has to offer for hosting through tomwoods.com/blue. And I'll give you free publicity for that blog if you use tomwoods.com/blue. Find out the details of my deal with you at tomwoods.com/publicity. Hello, Tom Woods here. Today I want to talk about social justice a little bit, and I want to talk about it in the context of a couple of articles written by the late philosopher Antony Flew in the Journal of Libertarian Studies. Now, Flew was a widely renowned philosopher, and we're lucky to say that he was also a libertarian. And in recent days and weeks, I've been actually going back and flipping through old issues of the Journal of Libertarian Studies. I have a lot of them in hard copy, but of course the entire print run of the JLS is available online thanks to the Mises Institute, just because I know from having read this journal so much when I was in college and grad school, there are so many great articles in it, and unfortunately it's just sitting there and people forget about it and they're not getting the benefit from it. So from time to time, I'm going to dig out one of these old classic articles and I'm going to review some of the points in it with you so that we do get all the goodies that we can get from the JLS. And today I wanted to talk about Flew's discussion of justice in two articles. They're quite similar, actually. When you look at them on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/495, you'll note that they are quite similar to each other. One of them is called Socialism and Social Justice, with quotation marks around the word social. And the other one is Enforced Equality or Justice. So we've got one from, that one's from 1986, and the other one is from 1995. Don't forget, by the way, my upcoming event, the Mises Circle in Dallas, October 3rd, 2015. If you are a listener of this show, you can get in for free. You don't have to pay the $95 admission fee. Just write to me at tomwoods.com. Use the contact page. You'll see the tab Contact on there at tomwoods.com. Just fill out the form and let me know that you're going to attend, and we'll get you registered and set up to make sure we have a lunch for you. So have fun. That's going to be great. Tom DiLorenzo, Jeff Dice, Lou Rockwell, and I will all be there. So a lot of fun. All right. Flew begins his article by quoting F.A. Hayek from his second volume of the Law, Legislation, and Liberty trilogy called The Mirage of Social Justice. And Hayek says, "I have come to feel strongly that the greatest service I can still render to my fellow men would be that I can make speakers and writers thoroughly ashamed to employ the term social justice." Hayek likewise says that the people who habitually employ the phrase simply do not know themselves what they mean by it and just use it as an assertion that a claim is justified without giving a reason for it. Well, this is actually a claim that Flew is going to challenge. He's going to say that people, in fact, do seem to know what they mean by social justice. They do have a definite meaning that they attach to it. And he says the expression social justice does appear to be employed by a great many people as almost, if not quite, synonymous with the word equality, which is then construed as involving neither equality before the law nor equality of opportunity, but equality of income or of outcome. He says, but now in that understanding, what is claimed to be demanded by social justice certainly is not and could not be justice. And what Flew is going to do early in his article is to try to explain what justice is, the way we've historically thought about justice in Western civilization, beginning all the way back in ancient Greece. What has been meant by justice? Because he thinks that if you're going to have a discussion of justice, or you're going to use a term like social justice, it's important first to understand what it is you're talking about. What actually is justice? And the point that he'll make in just a moment, I'm going to skip ahead to it now, and then after this, I'll give you what Flew says justice really is, referring to the Western tradition. He notes there's a curious omission in the work of John Rawls. And we've talked about John Rawls a few times on this show, and I am going to add on the show notes page links to the previous episodes where we've talked about John Rawls, a very, very important, influential American political philosopher of the 20th century. We're going to be talking about him in this episode as well. But John Rawls does believe in the idea of social justice. And he has a whole book called A Theory of Justice, and he's going to spell it out. But what Flew notices about it, and I pointed this out in a previous episode, is the following, and I love the way he phrases it. He says, readers of the Sherlock Holmes stories will remember the remarkable thing about Watson's hearing the dog barking in the middle of the night. The remarkable thing was that Watson did not hear it because no dog barked. The similarly remarkable thing about the definition of justice that Rawls provides is that he provides none. Nor does he offer any reasons for rejecting all traditional accounts. Indeed, this may well be the first work pretending to be a treatise on justice that is not, even in over 600 pages, able to find room to quote any of those previously mentioned variations on the theme of suum quique tribuere. I'll define that for you in a few minutes. He goes on to say that Rawls never finds room to quote, much less to examine, either some variant of the traditional definition of the word justice or any preferred alternative. Indeed, it is only on his 579th page that he thinks to explain, without any suggestion of apology, that he was eager, quote, to leave questions of meaning and definition aside and get on with the task of developing a substantive theory of justice. All right, so let's talk about what Flew says the Western tradition of justice has really been all about. And he goes back to Plato. And in Plato, a character named Polemarchus is scripted to say that his suggestion as to what justice is to render to each his due, which we later get in Latin as suum quique tribuere, to render to each his due. Then we have a further elaboration on this, to live honestly, to injure no one, and to render to each his own. He then elaborates on this and says that justice is essentially a backward-looking notion. What he means by that is that justice is concerned about people getting and being able to keep their several and presumably often different deserts and entitlements. Deserts and entitlements we have antecedently acquired by being what we are and have been, and by doing or refraining from doing what we either have done or have refrained from doing. The ideal based on equality, which he calls the Procrustean ideal or the social justice ideal, the ideal of a universal equality of condition, necessarily enforced and maintained by an all-intrusive socialist state, is equally essentially forward-looking, because it basically says that regardless of what people are or have been, or regardless of what people have or have not previously done, their future condition is to be made equal. Therefore, he says, social justice, as customarily conceived, is precisely not a kind of justice. He says, on the contrary, such so-called social justice essentially involves what the traditional definition of justice, just plain old justice without the word social in front of it, would have considered a classic case of obvious injustice. In other words, the threat of force being used to tax away some of the justly acquired property of the better off in order to give it to those whose previous just acquisitions or lack of just acquisitions have left worse off. And of course, the state keeps its often substantial service charge to facilitate this transfer. So what justice requires of you in the classical sense is simply to render to each what belongs to him, to render to each his rights, to do what everyone deserves. And Adam Smith explained this very concisely. He said, the man who barely abstains from violating either the person or the estate or the reputation of his neighbors has surely little positive merit. He fulfills, however, all the rules of what is peculiarly called justice and does everything which his equals can with propriety force him to do or which they can punish him for not doing. So this bare minimum of simply rendering to each his due is all that justice strictly requires of you. That was how justice has been conceived of down the centuries in Western civilization. Now, if compulsory transfers of the type envisioned by social justice, where some people have their stuff taken and other people get that stuff, if that's going to be justified and shown to be just, then you will have to show that the claims to that excess property that belongs to the better off are somehow unjust, and also that the people who are to be the new recipients of this stuff have just claims to this, to the possession of these things. These are individuals who don't know each other, who have had no interaction with one another, whose lives have taken completely different paths, and you would have to show that the one does not deserve what he has no right to it, has no just claim to it, but these strangers have a just claim to it. This is not an easy task. It's not one even attempted by Rawls. Let me remind you of how Rawls, in his famous work, A Theory of Justice, starts off his thought experiment. Because what he's trying to do is develop the principles on which a just society would be based. And he thinks that we develop these principles by imagining ourselves as sort of disembodied spirits who are not members of society yet, but we are thinking about society, and we're thinking about if we didn't know what place we would occupy in society, if we didn't know if we were going to be wealthy or impoverished, or if we were going to be male or female, or what race we were going to be, or if we were going to have talents or not have talents, if we didn't know any of these things, what principles would we want to govern society? And one of the reasons that he proposes that we think about it this way is he believes this will give us an impartial overview of the question, because we won't be tied down by our own identities. We won't be biased by our identities, because we won't have an identity yet. We'll just think, let's say, given that I don't know what I'm going to be, what would be the best arrangement of society so that even if I wound up in the most unfortunate situation, it still wouldn't be so bad? So that's what he calls the original position. The original position is we are operating behind a veil of ignorance about our own particular situation and what it's going to be. And in this original position, we have full disposition over property, liberty, opportunity. How would we distribute these things? Now, Flew critiques this whole approach. He says, first of all, we have the assumption that all present and potential property really belongs to the collective and is therefore available for distribution or redistribution and subject to no legitimate prior claims at the absolute discretion of that collective. And he goes on to say, this is a pretty big and fundamentally socialist assumption. And then he says, and I love this, he says, yet it is wholly typical of the unself-critical parochialism of Rawls that since he never even notices that he's making it, he finds no room to essay any justification. Then he goes on to say that consistent with this original, totally socialist assumption, Rawls also takes it absolutely for granted throughout that any particular rights or resources enjoyed by any individual either are or ought to be allocated collectively. So consider, for instance, these two statements. First, this is Rawls speaking. The justice of a social scheme depends on how fundamental rights and duties are assigned. Note the use of the word assigned. Well, this, again, assumes a huge amount that would presumably need to be proven, that rights and duties are things that are assigned. Then secondly, this also being from Rawls, the chief primary goods at the disposition of society. So again, the assumption that these things are at the disposition of society and there aren't any prior individual rights claims to these things, well, that is an assumption that needs to be justified. You can't just make that assumption and then go ahead and draw your conclusions from it as if this is simply obvious. So, the chief primary goods at the disposition of society, liberty and opportunity, income and wealth, are to be distributed equally. Well, who says these things are at the disposition of society? Where does that come from? There is an entirely different way of looking at society. You could look at it in a Lockean way, in which we have goods in the world that have no individual property titles to them, but eventually they come to have those individual property titles by means of homesteading, and then later through gift, bequest, exchange, sale, and so on. We have that kind of tradition. But this is not even allowed in Rawls's view, because all goods are at the so-called disposition of society at the very beginning. And here's another assumption that Rawls makes that Flew is going to critique. And it's so obvious to Rawls. He says this principle that we're about to talk about is so obvious that we would expect it to occur to anyone immediately. So obviously Rawls hangs around with nobody other than other philosophy professors in the faculty lounge. So everybody must think the way I do, or there's something wrong with them. And we have to, before we get into this, we have to understand another reason that Rawls wants us to begin behind this veil of ignorance, of not knowing what position we're going to occupy in society. This is stipulated in part so that we can look at our situation and the situation of society impartially and without personal bias that may come from knowing what position we're going to occupy. So in other words, if I know I'm going to be rich, then maybe I will want to adopt rules for society that benefit the rich. Well, if I don't know what I'm going to be, then this allows me to look at the rules for society more impartially without thought of my own particular advantage. There is that. But he also says there's another reason for looking at the world from behind a veil of ignorance. And he says that we are able to look at the world, leaving aside those aspects of the social world that seem arbitrary from the moral point of view. Well, for Rawls, what does he mean by things that seem arbitrary from the moral point of view? Well, according to Flew, when you really dig deeply into this concept, really Rawls means everything that distinguishes one individual from another. Everything, that is, that any individual has done or that another has not done, as well as everything that one individual is and another is not. Rawls's first principle of justice is the one requiring equal distribution of stuff. Well, Flew says, only by such wholesale discounting of all the differentiating characteristics of every individual as being allegedly morally irrelevant, only by doing this can Rawls maintain his supposedly quite obvious first principle of justice, one requiring equal distribution. So Rawls says that, for instance, your natural endowments are not deserved, that you are a great basketball player, you have talent for that, or you have a talent to be a great chess player, whatever. And then he draws from this the following, that whatever these endowments make possible cannot be a proper basis of desert. And secondly, because they're not deserved, they must therefore be in some scandalous way undeserved. And then he comes to the conclusion that he has established the principle that undeserved inequalities call for redress. And since inequalities of birth and natural endowments are undeserved, these inequalities are to be somehow compensated for. We compensate for it by basically arguing that the distribution of natural talents is a common asset and we should all share in it. Everybody else should share in it. Not just you, everybody should share in it. Because you don't deserve it, so everybody should share in whatever good comes of it. And if you have been favored by nature with some particular type of talent, you can gain from that good fortune only on terms that improve the situation of those who have lost out. So as I've given as an example on this show before, let's suppose I've been blessed with or just given some kind of natural intelligence that makes it possible for me to be a really, really good doctor. Now, if I'm entitled only to the same goods that everybody else is entitled to, I'm probably not going to go to the trouble to become a doctor. But if I'm allowed to have some extra if I'm a doctor, then maybe I'll become a doctor. So, therefore, according to Rawls, it's okay for me to have some extra because that's what gives me the incentive to become a doctor and therefore to serve the poor. The people who are the least well off would not be well served if I didn't become a doctor. So it's okay to give me extra reward, but not because I'm entitled to it. I certainly am not. But simply because my getting that little extra encourages me to become a doctor, and in becoming a doctor, I'm improving the situation of those who don't have the natural talents that I have. But he goes well beyond talking about intelligence or chess playing or whatever. He says, even, this is a direct quote from Rawls, even the willingness to make an effort, to try, and so to be deserving in the ordinary sense, is itself dependent upon happy family and social circumstances. So how about that? Even somebody who works hard, well, that's an undeserved talent. That's an undeserved characteristic that you got because you had the good fortune of being in a decent family, in a decent environment, with a decent upbringing, and so on. Flew says, typically, Rawls never notices how this assumption removes all possible grounds for individual self-respect, something he says he values greatly. David Gordon, who's been a guest on this show, says in response to this analysis by Rawls, first, if you don't deserve your talents or personality traits, what is left? Rawls has evacuated persons of their attributes, leaving virtually nothing behind. So it's an extremely dehumanizing philosophy. Further, suppose Rawls is right that people do not deserve their superior abilities. That is, they do not acquire these talents by superior moral merit. It does not follow that they are not entitled to benefit from them. Why does the fact that you do not deserve, in quotation marks, in Rawls's sense, your superior talents, imply that they ought to be transferred to society, to be managed for the benefit of the least well-off? Rawls winds up with a system in which society controls virtually all the important human attributes. Flew goes on to say that there are really, really bad consequences, even for the people supposedly on the receiving end of goodness from the state. They're the ones getting the redistributed property. There are bad consequences for them, for society, that it winds up making them worse off. And here he borrows from the analysis of Charles Murray, who's also been a guest on this show, who has a series of laws in his book, Losing Ground. I better write that down for show notes page. I hope I remember all this. Losing Ground. I'll link to the Flew articles, of course, too, tomwoods.com/495. But he calls it the law of unintended rewards. And it goes like this. Any social transfer increases the net value of being in the condition that prompted the transfer. So let's put that in a flesh and blood example. Let's say that you get all kinds of benefits, free this, free that, subsidized this, subsidized that, as long as you are unemployed and unmarried for at least a year. Well, therefore, you have made being unemployed and unmarried for at least a year a more desirable position to be in than it was before. And you may think to yourself, oh, but nobody makes crude calculations like that. But it turns out they do. It turns out that subsidies and incentives do make people do things that you wouldn't think they would do on the basis of those incentives alone, but they wind up doing them, in fact. And so you wind up with people being encouraged to be in highly desirable, highly undesirable situations. Now, obviously, a condition like being blind does not qualify here, because no one in his right mind chooses to be blind. Blindness is something that occurs either because of an accident or because you're born with it. That's a different type of question from what Flew is talking about. Flew says that many, perhaps most, of the conditions unintentionally rewarded by existing state welfare provisions are conditions into which at least some of their victims could and indeed ought to have avoided falling, and or which they could and indeed ought to escape partly or wholly by their own efforts. Now, of course, you're not allowed to say that, but what does he care? He's a dead philosopher at this point. Insofar as this is the case, the rewards that the welfare state gives must necessarily tend to weaken both any existing inhibitions against falling into these conditions and any existing incentives to escape them. In the case of many of these conditions, this alone should be recognized as a more than sufficient reason, as far as possible, both to maintain and to strengthen such inhibitions and such incentives. And of course, once people get into these habits of relying on the state. It's extremely difficult to get out of that and to learn different habits, different attitudes, different kinds of behavior. Now, remember also that equality is at the heart of the social justice message. It's not alleviating poverty. It's equality. So therefore, the definition of poverty will always be shifting. You'll never be able to say, well, we conquered that problem. It'll always be shifting. Because it doesn't matter that you're no longer as poor as the poor used to be. You're still not as rich as the rich are. So we haven't solved the problem. We keep moving the goalposts. And so the amount of the payments and the generosity of the welfare state, there is always going to be pressure for those things to expand under the pressure of this kind of ideology. Flew says, in any expanding economy in which the decision makers are misguided by ideals of equality and social justice, these amounts are bound to increase. Because these ideals require relativistic standards of poverty, according to which the size of the various welfare payments to be provided is determined, not by reference to some comparatively fixed and stable standard of hardship, but by reference to and relative to the rising average level of incomes over the population as a whole. Flew himself did believe in some very, very basic welfare state, and Hayek himself believed in some kind of a welfare state. He said that repeatedly. Hayek said, there is no reason why in a free society, government should not assure to all protection against severe deprivation in the form of an assured minimum income or a floor below which nobody needs to descend. That's Hayek. And Flew goes on to say, a prudent government, however, even when that assured minimum income was very low, would still, at least in the case of conditions which could have been avoided, try to find ways of channeling the necessary relief funds through private organizations, less inhibited from discriminating between deserving and undeserving recipients than our present welfare state bureaucracies. And then finally, he concludes with this. If justice really did require and warrant an equal distribution, then everyone would be entitled to no more and no less than an equal share. But now all the Procrustians, or all what we might call the social justice warriors of my own acquaintance, are, on these assumptions, rather conspicuously under-deprived. They are all, to speak less delicately, in possession and enjoyment of considerable amounts both of capital and income, to say nothing of power and position, over and above those equal or nearly equal shares to which alone they are, on their own accounts, justly entitled. So that is to say, they're only entitled to equal shares, but yet they have tremendously greater income, power, and position over and above those equal shares. So, in accordance with their own constantly reiterated principles, therefore, such excesses constitute property stolen from others. Because that's their view. You don't rightly hold property title to the excess property. And by keeping it, you are basically stealing it from others. So you've stolen this. Even these people advocating these positions have stolen this property from others worse off than themselves. This unlovely picture is not the one they want either to see themselves or to show to the rest of us. And of course, that's not to mention the problems that the egalitarians get themselves into when they talk about equality, and then they have to face the fact that countries are very unequal. So maybe they should divest themselves of all their greater than average income and send it to some really, really poor country somewhere. Of course, they don't want to do that. And I pointed this out on Facebook. Follow me on Facebook at facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods for goodness like this. I asked Bernie Sanders supporters, since you consider yourself entitled to help yourself to the goods of the rich, why do you not consider the poor countries of the world entitled to help themselves to what you have? Because when they look at you, to them, you live in the same kind of luxury and splendor that you see when you look at the American rich. You are just as richer than these people are as the American rich are than you. You belong to the global 1%. Why shouldn't you have to redistribute your income? And Rawls had real trouble solving that problem. I talk about that in a previous episode, and I show the lame ways that he tried to solve it, but they're totally unpersuasive. And the Bernie Sanders people, they had no idea. They didn't even understand the nature of the argument. They were saying, well, Bernie's not running for president of the world. Yeah, I get that. The point is that the principle is the same. I'm not saying that he would be in a position to redistribute income around the world. I'm saying the moral principle is the same. And if you believe in this as a moral principle, then regardless of whether Bernie has authority over the whole world or not, you should volunteer to give up your wealth. And yet I don't see any of you doing it. Why is that? So anyway, that's fun. Make sure you get my free ebook on Bernie Sanders, by the way, takes on all his arguments over at BernieIsWrong.com or by texting the name Bernie to 33444. Remember also, if you want to get into this conversation, or you want to improve your job standing by creating a blog that talks about all the good things going on at the company, or you want to show potential other employers your value, you should start a blog talking about all the advances in your field, everything going on in your field, books being released in your field. You will be viewed as a really indispensable and important person. And no one else in your field is going to be doing this. And this is a way you build up your credibility in your field. There's so many reasons to start a blog. And I've got a free book to show you how and why to do it. And I've got a free 5-minute video tutorial taking you from no blog to a blog. And I'm offering to give you free publicity for your blog through my audience. All this sort of stuff, you can check it out at tomwoods.com/publicity. The video tutorial, the free book, the publicity offer, it's all explained at tomwoods.com/publicity, but you have to check it out before you start that blog. Check it out before you start that blog. Get your hosting through tomwoods.com/blue, and you're guaranteed the lowest pricing that they offer, and I will give you the free publicity. So check it out at tomwoods.com/publicity. That's everything for today. The show notes page is tomwoods.com/495. I'll have these Anthony Flew links. I'll have a couple of books that I mentioned. I'll have previous episodes that are relevant. All this stuff is a ton of fun. Check it out at tomwoods.com/495. Tomorrow we're going to be talking to Paul Gottfried, who returns to the show, and we're going to talk about his article, Wilsonianism, The Legacy That Refuses to Die. How can you miss that? Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.